Well, thank you. Especially want to thank those of you that actually helped us produce If God Created the Universe. So if you actually go through that series, you'll see a number of the class personalities that were involved in that. And some of it is fairly humorous, so that might be a little encouragement to get you to think about it. But it's all thanks to a couple of business people in Austin, Texas, who said, look, we want you to produce a video series that is reproducible. And so what it is, it's about 8 15 to 20 minute video segments that's designed for a class. So they basically watch a DVD for 15 or 20 minutes. There's some Q&A that they can watch that I fielded live right there. And then it kind of launches them into study questions and discussion. We provide a little teacher's manual. And the whole vision of these two businessmen in Texas is that we would produce a series that would be, you know, very accessible to all audiences and reproducible. In other words, our goal is, say, if 20 people wind up participating in the class, that, say, 3 or 4 of them would wind up teaching the class after they were done. It's really designed to make it very easy to teach a class. So, yeah, it's like an 8-week series. And the goal is, if this does well, we'll keep producing them. In fact, we have plans to do one just on the first chapter of the Bible, since that's kind of the biggest barrier to people taking the Bible seriously. So, but the whole idea is you make it really bite-sized and really at a lay level so that everybody can assimilate the material. And yeah, it's based on the book Why the Universe is the Way It Is. I think the reason why it works is that book is a fairly easy read. Well, I've been gone one Sunday, but a lot's gone on since last Sunday. First of all, I flew out to Virginia Beach to do several things with the Christian Broadcasting Network. They had me on their main news show, and I was actually interviewed by Pat Robertson. I was told you got 6 minutes, and so, but he got so excited they gave me 8 minutes. So. but no, it had a huge impact. It wound up putting the book over there, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, on the bestsellers list for books that deal with science and religion. In fact, we were number one for a whole week. And even amongst all books, we reached a point where we were the 179th best-selling book in all categories, including fiction. So that was all thanks to that TV thing. Well, that and the fact that after I did the interview with Pat Robertson, they had me go into a studio, and we did 3 different news programs on different aspects of what's in the book on the science and creation content that Job talks about. And that was about 45 minutes total. So I think that also had an impact. That was just a one-day trip. I went there, flew back. And then I was home for a day, and I went up to Seattle, Washington, and I spent about a week up in Seattle. And, things always happen when you're flying, because my colleague, Ken Holcrum, went up there to help organize all the events. He's our events coordinator. And he got a direct flight. I had to take 2 legs, and we're all commenting, how come you got to have to take 2 legs and I get a direct flight? Well, what happened is he got his ticket late and somebody canceled on a direct flight, so he got to take the direct flight. But he got there a little bit ahead of me, even though I left first. But it all worked out great, because I took this flight from Ontario Airport to San Francisco, and I got to sit beside a cancer surgeon at Loma Linda. And so we got to talking about that. And then he found a little bit about what I do. He told me, well, I go to a Seventh-day Adventist church, but they're very anti-scientific and anti-intellectual, and I've been trying to find some way to break through with some rational Christian apologetics material. Never heard about us. I'd actually spoken at his hospital 3 times, but it was always times when he was out of the state, because he does do quite a bit of travel. Quite a well-known surgeon. Anyway, bottom line is, he got really excited about our ministry, took some material, and says, we're going to arrange to have you speak at our church and see if we can turn our church around. So, then I got on the plane from San Francisco to Seattle, And, you know, I could see the plane was overbooked. It was overbooked by about 20 passengers. And they kept calling names. Then they called my name, and I got really frightened. I says, oh, no, I got to speak tonight, and they're going to bump me. But they called me up and said, you know, Mr. Ross, would you terribly mind flying first class? Well, it's only the second time in my life I've flown first class. And actually, what happened, it was about 20 years ago, a similar thing happened. In fact, I tell a story in the book on Job, one of the introductions of chapters, is the one other time I got to fly first class, wound up sitting beside a Montreal businessman who was a real fan of the Montreal Canadiens. He got super excited when he found I was born in Montreal and that my father had designed the boards for the forum in Montreal that the Canadiens use in consultation with people like Rocket Richard and Boom Boom Jeffrey. I said, your dad knew those guys? He says, yeah, he consulted with them, and he had a lifetime pass to the hockey games. Well, he wound up coming to the Lord as a result of that flight. Well, something similar happened in this flight. I got pumped up to first class, and who sat beside me? A German atheist skeptic quantum physicist. Now, what are the odds of an atheist quantum physicist sitting beside a Christian astrophysicist? So, and he told me that he was definitely a skeptic and an atheist. Was, you know, kind of hostile to start with, but it quickly melted as we got talking. And he wound up, says, look, I've never seen a scientific approach to the Christian faith before. He says, that's something I'm really interested in. And we just talked for a couple of hours, which worked out well because the flight was slow. It got delayed landing in there. So he got some extra time to talk. And then he said, do you have anything in German? And I said, well, I happen to have Journey Toward Creation in my briefcase. And he looked at it and says, I got to watch this. And he wound up taking a copy. He said, what's your easiest to book read? So I gave him Why the Universe is the Way It Is. I didn't have a copy of the Job book. So he says, I will get back to you after I finish reading this and let you know what I think of it. So anyway, there's something I've said before in this class, that just like God took Philip and put him right beside the Ethiopian eunuch, he will do the same with you if you will follow through on 1 Peter 3:15 and 16. Always be ready to give reasons for the hope within you with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. And God will do those kinds of things in your life simply because the workers are few. He has to supernaturally put them together just because of how few the workers are that are out there. Well, things were kind of exciting in the Pacific Northwest. I won't give you all the details, but it ended with a forum with Peter Ward. And Peter Ward has been on television a lot. He's an atheist paleontologist and astrobiologist, although his training is in biology and in geology. And I just finished reading this book, Under a Green Sky, one of his latest books that he has written. And quite an interesting book because he's trying to investigate what's going on with all the mass extinctions of life and why does life appear so rapidly after each mass extinction. And kind of his approach is evolution must be far more efficient than we ever dreamed of in order for this to be a possibility. It's like the God option never really came to him. And the other thing I appreciated about the book is that he documents what an incredibly optimum time we human beings are living in the history of the Earth. At no other time in the history of the Earth have conditions been so ideal for advanced life. That's a good chunk of what the book is talking about. And his real passion for writing the book is we're messing it up and we need to restore it to the pristine condition that we found it in. And so he's a real advocate of trying to do something about correcting the global warming problem. He's trying to alert people to the crisis we're in. But at the same time, he just documents just what an incredibly optimal time we're existing in right now, which kind of fits right into this theme of what we talked about 2 weeks ago when I was here. We humans have been here for just about a whisper of the universe's history. But in that 0.3 seconds compared to 24 hours, we are living at an incredibly optimal time. And some of the things he talks about here are how the continents are oriented north-south, the continents of just the right shape and size, so that if you've got cold poles and warm tropics, it forces the circulation of water. So you've got the Gulf Stream, you've got the Japanese current, you've got all these currents flowing in the oceans in such a way to keep the oxygens fully oxygenated and also to make sure that the climate is ideal for advanced life around the planet. And how, you know, if we melt the polar caps, we could be in danger of breaking up those currents and things won't be so ideal anymore. Kind of ends the book of what we got to look forward to. Instead of a blue sky, a green sky. He claims that, you know, if we stop the Gulf Stream current, the Japanese current, it's going to lead to the ocean depths becoming devoid of oxygen. And as they become devoid of oxygen, it's going to cause hydrogen sulfate proliferating bacteria to multiply, which is going to transform the atmosphere and actually make it deadly poisonous for advanced life. And so we won't be able to live here any longer. Well, we've got other reasons for explaining why we're not going to live here any longer, even if we do take care of things the way they should be. But I think what was really interesting is how our dialogue ended. First of all, it kind of surprised me because it was set up for the two of us to give a talk and then to have a dialogue with one another and then communicate with the audience. But he brought a colleague with him from Caltech to help him with the questions. And so it was supposed to be 50-50 on the question. Basically, we had to split it up into thirds. I wasn't told this until I walked into the auditorium that there would be a third person there. On the other hand, it was Joe Krishvink, and I've read a number of his papers, so I was kind of eager to talk to him. He's really into meteorites, and especially interested in that one that Bill Clinton did a dance around. Do you remember that one? ALH-84001, where they thought they had found life. Well, Joe thinks that there still is the signs of life in that. Probably the only scientist that does right now, so I was kind of talking to him about this. But the way it ended up, Peter Ward said, you know, I've debated Christians, but you're the only one I'm interested in debating in the future. He says, you guys at Reasons to Believe are real scientists, and you know, you guys are credible. I'm starting to read your books. They make sense. And says, can we take this show on the road? So he's really interested in doing future things with us. And I think what could be good, he wrote that book, Rare Earth, with the astronomer Don Brownlee. And we've interviewed Don. Now, he describes himself as an agnostic. I think it might be good if we did something with Don Brownlee and Peter Ward with me and Fuzz Rana, because that would really give a good balance. We'd be both, because when Peter Ward spoke, he basically spent his entire time, he spoke second, and you know, he was going to give a response to what I said, but he spent almost his entire time speaking on the origin of life. And so we wound up talking a little bit about that during our dialogue time. But anyway, it went very well, and I think, you know, there's a good opportunity. And by the way, what struck me most about Peter Ward, he calls himself an atheist, and he does have a lot of, some bitter experiences with Christian apologists. But he is recognizing there are people who are Christians and there are people who are Christians. So I think that's helpful. But someone in the audience asked him, well, Peter, what's your faith? And he said, well, I don't really have a faith. I'm having so much fun doing my scientific research that I've never really thought about any other issues pertaining to life. Well, he's about my age. And it's like, you know, you better start thinking sooner or later because you're not going to live forever. But he reminds me so much of many other very accomplished scientists. I saw this a lot at Caltech and at the University of Toronto. Scientists that are having so much fun doing science. And if you actually read this book, Under a Green Sky, he starts every chapter with a story from his scientific research experience. And you can really see the thrill he gets from scientific discovery. In fact, I saw this with the atheist Nobel laureate physicist Richard Feynman at Caltech. I mean, his whole passion for life was to make that one grand discovery, and how that gives you an euphoric feeling that just kind of keeps you going. But the euphoric feeling lasts, what, maybe 24 hours, 48 hours, and then it's gone. But I saw that with Peter, too. He just told the audience, you know, I'm having such a thrill doing science. And he was really trying to promote science education. He said, all of you need to enroll in our science departments at the University of Washington, and you'll have the same kind of fun that I'm having. But it's not just scientists I see this. When I've been speaking on seminary campuses, I also run into theologians who are having so much fun studying this book and making discoveries out of the Bible that they really don't give much attention to the most important issues of life. And when you read Psalm 19, it tells us that God gave us two books. He gave us the book of Scripture, what's called the law, and he also gave us the heavens, the record of nature. Now, God's words are written upon the heavens for all of us to read. And one thing I was sharing with a couple of audiences up in there in Seattle, if you're a follower of Jesus Christ, the Bible commands you to be a theologian. You don't leave it up to your pastors and seminary professors. We're all called to be students of the Bible, to study and research the Bible, and make discoveries from the Bible that we can apply in our own lives. But at the same time, if you're a follower of Jesus Christ, you're commanded to be a scientist. We're all scientists if we're followers of Jesus Christ. You don't leave it up to professionals like myself. The Bible commands each one of us to study and research the record of nature and make discoveries. But notice there's a warning in Romans 1. In your passion to research the record of nature, be careful not to transfer worship away from the Creator to the creation. And I think I even see that with theologians. They begin worshiping this book instead of the author of this book. And it's great to have fun making all these discoveries. In fact, if you read, the book on Job, you can see some of the joy I got from making discoveries in that ancient book of the Bible that was relevant for today's science. But that's not the end all. The end all is, okay, why are we here? Why is the universe here? Why did God create me? Why did he create me at the time that he did? That's something we're studying in Psalm 139, how God chooses the time and the place for the birth of every human being. So think about where you were born. Think about the date in which you were born and realize there's a purpose in that date and that time. And there's also a purpose in God choosing the day that you will leave this planet. And so trying to determine, why am I here? What does God want me to do? And what about my life in the creation yet to come? Because that 0.3 seconds is going by fast. By the way, the 24 hours is 13.75 billion years. But as we're going to talk about in a few minutes, we got at most 20,000 years left. And that's all. And it's going to be over for the human species, at least in a civilized state. But this is not the end all. What's distinct about Christianity compared to all other religions, it's not God restoring humanity to paradise. It's God taking humanity from paradise to a brand new creation where the physics is different. And by the way, I got to share this in that platform with Peter Ward, that one of the reasons why God takes us through some of the pain and suffering and exposure to evil in this creation is it's all designed to teach and prepare and train us for a career in the new creation. And don't have so much fun doing your science. Don't have so much fun making discoveries of this book of the Bible that you forget to pay attention to your future career in the new creation. God is preparing each one of us for an incredible career. And just like I've noticed as a professor, if students have no career goal, they have a hard time with the class. It's the students that do have a clear career goal that relish the experience, the suffering. As I told the students up there in Seattle, my role as a professor is to make all of you suffer. That's my job. I'm being paid to make you suffer. But there's benefit to suffering because it prepares you for a future career. But as the words of the Apostle Paul in the book of Hebrews, the author of the book of Hebrews said, every day, spend some time thinking about your future career in the new creation. And I think that's my one criticism of Peter Ward. He's having so much fun doing science, he doesn't really pay any attention. In one sense, scientific research is kind of like one of these absorbing video games. You know, it becomes so addicting that you forget about sleeping, you forget about eating, you forget about the other families, the members of the family. That can happen too with both the Bible and scientific research. That's enough preaching from me today, but go ahead.
I was just curious, you're basically saying, is this life a test for us for the afterlife? Kind of,
in the sense that you are being taken through the equivalent of a course. And yes, you have to pass the course. There is a test. This life is a test. One of the things you notice that in the book of Revelation, there will come a time when the creator of the universe himself will return to planet Earth and rule for 1,000 years here on planet Earth and basically make everything perfect like it was in the Garden of Eden. But at the end of that 1,000 years, he releases Satan from his prison, the great tempter. And he allows Satan to tempt all the children born during the millennium. Why? No one gets to the new creation without first going through the ultimate test. Just like nobody gets a PhD unless they go through they have to go through two tests. We go through what are called the comprehensives. And I remember at the University of Toronto, we studied for 2 years for those comprehensive exams. And what are the comprehensives? That's where you got about a dozen astronomy professors grilling you all afternoon about your competency in different disciplines of astronomy. And if you get through that, they let you write a thesis. But when you finish your thesis, there's a thesis defense. And once again, you get a room full of professional astronomers who grill you on the competency of your thesis research. Then they give you this piece of parchment that says PhD on it. But you know what that piece of parchment does? It guarantees that never again will I have to be tested for my competency in astronomy. Based on the myth that my professor subjected me to the most difficult test, so there's no point putting me through another test. Likewise, God has set up things in such a way that he's subjecting us to the most difficult tests. Keep in mind, Satan's the most powerful creature he ever made. There is no more challenging tempter than Satan himself. And God is allowing Satan to tempt us and to test us under the most trying, under the most difficult conditions. But if I could use one other analogy there. I remember showing up at the first day of the University of Toronto. There were 13 of us in the freshman graduate class. And the professor sat us down and said, you know, this is the University of Toronto. It's the finest institution in Canada. We all know that you're very hardworking. You're prepared to work hard. We also know that you're bright. You know, we checked your test scores from your undergraduate institutions. But we guarantee this. If you do not come to us, the professors, for help with this course of studies, you will not make it. We don't care how bright you are. We don't care how hardworking you are. You will not make it. You need our help. Well, likewise, God is subjecting us to the most difficult tests, but he's offering to help us pass. And he says, if you will take my help, I guarantee you'll pass this test. And as you pass that test, never again can anything ever threaten you to be tempted by evil's ways. And this is what's going to prepare us to receive a career in the new creation that's greater than any career job that God will give to the angels. We're going to be placed above the angels. Why are we being placed above the angels? Because we got to go through the course. We got to go through the tests. They had to watch us going through the course and the tests. But we get to experience it. And because we experience it, we are being trained and equipped for a much higher role than any of the angels can take. So, that's what's going on here, and basically, we need to make sure we don't get distracted from the good things of life. And part of those good things is all the wonderful stuff going on in the record of nature, all the great discoveries that people are making. If I've got time, I'm going to tell you about a couple of discoveries that got made just in the last 3 days, but likewise, the discoveries we talk about here in class. You know, our generation is making discoveries in this book that had never been made before. People have been studying this for 3,500 years, and yet we are privileged to be making brand new discoveries, and by the way, there's still a whole lot more to learn. you've had your hand up the longest. Go.
In relative to Revelation and final judgment, it's been said, okay, it's in scriptures, that none shall go to the Father except through me. So the creator of the world, who's the second person, and the redeemer of the world, will now come and judge the world, and all go through him to the Father.
Right.
Isn't that what that means?
Yes. Yeah, that's part of what it means. Okay, go ahead.
This is a more down-to-earth request. Can you block out some time in your schedule for having us have a star party there?
Oh, yeah. That's always fun. And, you know...
It's on your calendar, though, so... You're the man. We can adjust everything we're doing, but, you know, maybe sometime in December, January, whenever...
Well, you may want to wait a little bit longer, because the best place to go for a star party that's easy to get to is that Saddle Point that's 6 miles west of Wrightwood. You can literally get there in 45 minutes from here without any serious mountain driving. If you take the 210 and then get on to 15, go the back way up to Wrightwood. It's a real easy drive. And it's 7,400 feet above sea level. Huge parking lot, and there's not many trees there, so you get decently stable sky. And by the way, you can see the Milky Way with the naked eye from there. So it sits about the darkest sky you're going to find within an easy drive from here. But because of 7,400 feet, it's chilly in the wintertime. If we go there in January, I guarantee you'll be gone in 10 minutes. So. Because the problem with the star party, you're standing around. And I can tell you, I've been in telescopes of 15 below before. Even when you put on one of these polar survival suits, you're shivering the entire time. I mean, it keeps you alive, but that's barely. So, however, one of the nice things about this place, it's actually got a facility there with flush toilets. And that's helpful. But no. I've got this telescope that you can plug into a car battery, and it literally will take you to any object you want, and it's more than 11 inches in diameter. You'll get spectacular views. You'll actually be able to see the spiral arms of M51 through that telescope. So it's a nice experience. But I found probably the best time to do this would be late March, early April. That's a good time to see the biggest globular cluster in our galaxy, the Omega Centauri. It only rises 4 degrees above our horizon, but April is when you can see it easily in the early evening. So that may be a good time to try to schedule something like that.
Why don't you do that now?
Well,
slip away.
That's how it should be done. I would recommend that, you know, get one of the leaders in the class here to call our office and get it on the calendar, and we'll make that happen. By the way, the last time we did this, just a little caution, I've got this telescope which will automatically put the object right smack in the middle of the eyepiece if nobody touches the telescope. If you touch the telescope, I got to set it up all over again. That's hard to do in the dark. So, okay, yeah.
Yeah, listen, I'm going to dwell for any more tests. And if
that's why you're here, Al.
God knows everything. He's going to know what I'm going to get in a test anyhow. So what's the purpose of all this testing on it? The thing is also, when God comes again, Jesus comes again, is that before or after the 12th Imam comes for the Muslims, or the real Messiah for the Jews, which is going to be the same thing as, like you say, as Jesus is going to do. They have the same plan, almost. So, which is coming first? I mean,
well, you need to read Zechariah 13. Zechariah 13 lays out a prophecy for the modern Jews. It says there will come a time when they'll recognize the one they have pierced, and realize that the Messiah indeed is Jesus of Nazareth. And it says on that day, 1/3 of all Jews living in the world will become followers of Jesus Christ. Because they'll see certain signs that are prophesied in the book of Ezekiel and Daniel that will convince them the Messiah has already come. Now, if the Messiah has already come, there's only one possible candidate, Jesus of Nazareth.
How about the 12th Imam?
Well, you're going to have a hard time convincing Jews of that, as well as Christians. I mean, after all, you've got the Buddha saying that there's going to be a reincarnation of Buddha coming back. You've got Hindus making a similar thing. And by the way, that also is prophesied in the Bible, that there would be many who would claim to be, quote, the Messiah. It says many false Christs will come, many false prophets will come. And what do we see in 1 John chapter 4, chapter 3, pardon me? Put the prophets to the test. Test every spirit, because many people will claim to be Christ, but really will not.
How are you going to test them?
Well,
walk on water?
No. Read this book. It tells you how to test them.
Might add the 12th Iman. He will kill the Jews and he'll force everybody in the world to accept Islam or die. That certainly is
that's
not
it.
The Jesus Christ.
That's it.
So that's an easy test.
No, Christian. When Jesus comes, everybody's going to be a Christian.
No, it doesn't say that.
That doesn't say that.
No.
Well, how are they going to go to heaven?
Not everybody goes to heaven. The only people who go to heaven are people who want to go to heaven. If you don't want to go, God's not going to force you to go. Heaven is a place where you have to submit to the authority of the Creator of the universe for the rest of eternity. And if you don't want to do that, God's got another place for you.
Alice brings up great promise. You promised us in the class in which you agreed Creator of the Cosmos, and you once again are asking questions that are totally addressed in that book under the topic of free will and predestination. Will you promise that once again that you'll read the chapter on predestination and free will so you'll understand that topic from a biblical position from
you? I've read it a million times. Yes.
You have read it a million times? Then why are you asking questions about predestination when you understand that there's free will? Are you choosing to ignore free will?
Well, you know what might be fun in this class? By the way, I think everybody needs to really understand and study this doctrine of divine predestination and human free will. It's something that people have struggled with for centuries. But you know what? We have a book over there called Beyond the Cosmos. I think it'd be fun if we were to have like a little contest here. Al, we can put you in a stool. We'll put three others on a stool. And we'll ask you questions. And we'll have a prize. We'll have a first prize and a booby prize. Okay? Does that sound like fun? Maybe we can even do this at our Christmas party or some other time, independent of the party.
Talk to me after class. I will get on the calendar, okay?
Yeah, I think that'd be good. Well, I mean, I'm not saying it'll just be fun. I think it's going to be a great teaching tool if we do this. So I'm going to be looking for four volunteers, but Al, I want you to be one of the four volunteers. Well, the Christmas party, I'm going to probably recommend maybe we do it the Sunday of the Christmas party. It'd be fun to do it right here because it really would be a good teaching experience. We'll organize something. Okay. Not Christmas Day, but I mean, I'm talking about the day of the Christmas party, December 4th. Well, I'll work it out with the leaders here, but I think it's something that'd be really fun to do, and it's also a great way to learn some things about predestined free will. Yeah.
I was just curious, if this lifetime is our test of the afterlife, is it possible to cram before the final exam? I know the final exam may be, you know you're not going to know when you die, and so I guess you have to be ready.
Well, that's the whole point. You nailed it right. You got it exactly right on. We're to cram for that final exam, and God gives you 80 or 90 years to cram for that final exam.
You can't do it, say, the last year of your life or the last month.
Well, like, you know, when I act as a professor and some students say, you know, can I just read the book 24 hours before the test and pass? Not likely. So it can be done, but it's not likely. And God gives you time. That's why you're here. And we'll be talking a little bit about this, about the value of optimized lifespans. If you're here too long, it doesn't work well. If you're not here long enough, it doesn't work well. I'll give you an example just from my professorial experience. If I tell the students they can take as long as they want on the tests, my experience is they don't do as well on the tests if I give them a time limit. And if I don't give them enough time, they panic and they don't do well. And I've taken classes like that where a professor assigns us an exam and you look at the paper, I mean, it's like 60 pages long and you figure there's no way I could finish this even if I had 8 hours and I've only got 3 hours. And so we all kind of panic trying to get as much done as possible. I can tell you from experience, even the best students do not perform well on that kind of a test. And likewise, they don't perform well if they've got too much time. Because if you've got too much time, you kind of get lazy and don't really put the effort and the work in. And the worst thing of all is when a professor says, I'm going to post this test up on the web, and you can take it as many times as you want. When you do that, nobody studies. They just keep taking the test over and over again, hoping eventually they'll pass it by sheer luck. And, you know, typically if you take an exam 30 or 40 times, one of those times you will pass it by sheer luck, especially if it's multiple choice. It's practically guaranteed that you're going to pass, but you won't learn a thing, and you won't be prepared. And God has given each of us an optimal time, not the same. That's something else I've noticed as a professor. Some students do better when they got 3 hours on the test. Some do better when they got four. Some do better when they got two. You know, it would be really great if you could actually optimize the time for every individual student in the class. But by law, we can't do that. Everybody's got to get the same break. But God knows what's perfect for each one of us. And he makes sure each one of us gets exactly the right amount of time. That's why it tells us in Psalm 139, God determines the day of your birth. He also determines the day of your death. He doesn't tell you the day of the death because, there again, that would affect the way we live our lives. We wouldn't perform as well in the test. But he's got the optimal time for each one of us. So some of you that are living on and on, God knows you need extra time. So
can we fake God out and pretend we're a slow learner?
Well, keep in mind the test is not the same for every individual Christian. Moreover, God is using your tests to reach other people. And so there again, that may predicate you dying early or predicate you God living on and on. I've seen a number of situations where the early death of an individual led to others in that person's sphere of influence from responding to God's call on their lives. So we just don't know what's best. We have to trust God for the best timing for each of our lives. And some of us who are older and have faced life-threatening situations, you know what I'm talking about. You go into the hospital, you don't know whether your time is up right now or God's going to give you 20 extra years. But you realize he knows best, I'm going to trust him. And just see what happens. Yes.
If I'm a materialist reductionist, I mean, certainly there's not such a thing as predestination. And there's not such a thing as free will either. We're all just zombies. We don't really make decisions. Is that right?
That would be right. I mean, it's pointless having an exercise here in predestination and free will if you don't believe in God in the first place, because neither doctrine would be true, and therefore just forget about it. But forgetting about it can have dire consequences if it is true. It's kind of like Pascal's wager. You know, if God really does exist, and there is a heaven and a hell, and if you ignore all that stuff, then the consequences are fairly severe. Whereas if the Christian is wrong, the Christian is no worse off than the atheist. They both wind up with the same effect. Therefore, if you're a betting man, you're going to bet where you got the greatest gain and the greatest amount to lose, which is Pascal's point. You better take the serious faith seriously because of the consequences it has in your future, if it is true. Yes.
I would say if you're a materialist reductionist, then predestination is all there is, because if there's no right. spiritual world, everything is going to simply play out by the laws of physics, and you really don't have any free will.
Right. Well, you know, when I debated Victor Stenger at Caltech in front of the Skeptic Society, they gave him the last word, and you'll see it on the DVD there. The last thing he says to that audience, remember, you're all cold nothing. You have no purpose. You have no destiny. You're just dust. And don't take, I mean.
Well, that's
well, they said, Victor, we're going to give you the last word in this debate, and that's what he said to the audience. But you know what? I went up to him and talked to him afterwards and said, of all the atheists I've talked to today, you're the one that's honest about the consequences of atheism. He says, well, that's how I feel. I mean, that's, if you're going to be a rational atheist, that's what it's all about. Okay. John, you haven't had a chance yet.
Someone that works at Caltech in the counseling center And she says the people on that campus are the most mixed up people she's ever encountered, and almost every client that comes to them is on some kind of drug. They're on antidepressants or something, and they've got all kinds of mental confusion. And I can believe that that view that is propagated is partly responsible.
Paul, when I was at Caltech, the antidepressant that was most commonly used was digging into scientific research and getting a thrill from the scientific research. That was kind of their drug. So, and I've had some of those exciting times. I can see how it can really captivate you. But there's more to life than just making discoveries. That's a story I tell in one of my books about how I was discovering all these new quasars, but recognizing the quasars are not eternal. When a human being goes from a life of sin to a life of repentance, a new life in Jesus Christ, that's eternal. And therefore, seeing someone give their life to Christ has far more significance and importance than discovering a quasar at the edge of the universe. That's really why I left Caltech and joined the ministerial staff here at Sierra Madre Congregational Church. Because it was more exciting for me to see something of eternal destiny take place than simply doing research on a quasar that isn't going to last for another billion years anyway. Well, when I was at the University of Toronto, they had us astronomers on the top floor of a 16-story building. It was the tallest building on the campus. We had our telescopes on top. We occupied the two top floors. But the second tallest building on the campus was a mental hospital. It was 12 stories high and was right next to the physics and astronomy department. And the joke was we needed a corridor to go from the two because of how frequently.
You talking about the Clark Institute?
I forget what it's called, but you've been there. Well, you know what was really humorous for me? Because, when I told you that story about our freshman class of 13 being told by the professors, look, if you don't get our help, you're not going to make it. Well, a couple of them weren't really taking that advice, and they wound up spending time in that 12-story building. So I went to visit them. And when I was visiting them, I saw one of my professors in the other room. So I went over and talked to him and said, what are you here for? I don't think you're fit. And he says, look, being a professor here is extremely stressful. They give us vacations, but when I go on vacation, they call me, and they're always hassling me about, I got to get this done and get this done. What I do is I check myself for a month into this hospital, and nobody bothers me. So, this is my vacation. And because I'm not really seriously mentally ill, they let me out when I want to get out. So, but now, go ahead.
Yeah, you say there's a book of nature and the book of the Bible, I guess you'll say. If you go by the book of nature, which I do, we hate to admit that we're animals, but we look at nature, we're the same as all other animals, all other mammals.
Oh, no, you need to read my book on Job.
Al, I'm asking you a question. You bought this book two weeks ago. Are you reading it?
I read it.
Have you read the chapter with your name in it yet? What does it say about you?
I read about how God and Satan are conspiring to bring all these maladies to Job, who doesn't know about it, and they're up there talking to each other. And who's there to record in heaven what they're talking to each other? Who's there?
God was there.
God was there. Well, did God write anything about that? I don't think.
Well, that's the whole no. Al. This book was written by 39 authors who were all inspired by God Himself to make sure that what they wrote was true.
Getting back to nature, we're animals. So the reason that we have all these religions and this hope and we have to find a purpose for life is that we die. And nobody knows what happens there. Nobody. If somebody came back from the dead and said, look, here's what happens, there's a heaven, or there's a hell, we wouldn't be having all these religions. Okay? So the
Okay, Al, just stop a minute, okay?
We're natural.
4 years ago, my father was told by the doctors that he had about a month to live. He had mesothelioma, which is asbestos lung cancer, because of his previous jobs. So he asked me at one point, he was a brand new Christian, what's it like to die? And I said, this is what you can know about death. That when a follower of Jesus Christ dies, they will be informed, usually 24 to 48 hours before the actual event, that the time is at hand. So they'll get that premonition. And they'll actually have a time when they actually feel pretty decent and can, you know, communicate to people that they love at that time. But at the very moment, you will see Jesus. He will call you by name and take you across the threshold of death. You will not die alone. And so when you hear your name being called, then you know this is it.
Sort of a near-death experience?
Psalm 23. Read Psalm 23. Yea, though I go through the valley of the shadow of death, you there are with me, and you will guide me and take me. And then look at the story of Stephen, who's being stoned to death by these Jewish religious leaders. And at one point, as the stones were bringing death to his point, he said, I see him. He saw Jesus, which of course got the religious leaders even more upset, throwing more stones. But Stephen saw Jesus, heard his name, and went across the threshold and said, do not hold this sin against him. Well, one of the young men that was there was Saul, who later became Paul. And notice that Stephen's willingness to die at the height of his ministry in his youth is what opened the way for Saul to become Paul and write 13 books that are here in the Bible. And so that's an example of a young man being willing to die and having that have a big impact on the people around him. But he heard his name being called. Now, my dad also asked me, what's it like if you're not a believer? Well, if you're not a believer, at the moment of death, it'll become completely obvious to you that judgment is coming just around the corner. And it's going to be a terrifying experience. And then you'll go to the place of your choice.
You don't know that. I mean, who's ever come back from dying?
Okay. How do I know that this is true? Okay. There's a pastor on our staff. He's not on our staff anymore, but he was for like over 35 years, and that's Richard Anderson. And, I've known him throughout all that time. And what Richard Anderson loved to do is spend time with people at the doorway of death. And he's watched hundreds of people at that doorway of death. I've only seen a few, but he's seen hundreds. And what he tells me is nobody dies sitting on the spiritual fence. You're either committed to be a follower of Satan or you're committed to be a follower of Christ. And when the person is committed to be a follower of Satan, who is lucid, now that was the big caveat. He says, I'm talking about people who are actually lucid at the time of death. Most people aren't. They're in a coma. They're not able to communicate. But he says, for those people who are able to communicate, if they're a follower of Jesus Christ, he says, every one of them has said, I hear my name. I got to say goodbye. And, you know, Jesus is there. And for those who don't know Jesus, they say, it's dark, and there's judgment. So he says, it's either one way or the other. There's a famous story of Einstein. I don't know whether it's true or not, but the truth was, or the story is, that when he was at the doorway of death, he said, it's dark, it's too late, I'm gone. So, yeah. So, he...
I was just going to say that I'm a social worker since 1993, and the majority of all the patients that I've had, they have had therapy for so many years, and psychiatrists and psychologists and so forth. They haven't gotten any better. Studying under you for many, many years, and other people, I've learned how to be able to present my faith in such a way where people receive it. And these are homeless people, addicts, and so forth. What makes me so sure of Christ is that these people, and I have hundreds and hundreds of them, once they started to read Holy Scripture, to write life. Every patient of mine, a study Bible. That is the only thing that has transformed their life. I have had psychiatrists, psychologists, and I'm talking about people in the Department of Mental Health who knew these people, and they actually said there's no hope for them. They are mentally ill. I have right now people in college becoming lawyers, people that want to understand what happened to them going into the psychology.
Mm-hmm.
I have teachers who were in the streets that were so-called mentally ill, and they will tell you the only thing that has transformed them was this book.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in 1998. It is so powerful that when you read it and apply it and live it and teach it, I cannot explain how, but the good Lord comes and now he's able to do a work.
Right.
And I thank you, because when I was a student, I was being hit with a lot of questions that I didn't know how to answer. And your books assisted me, Dr. James Dobson, in the psychology department and so forth. So, being transformed only takes place here. Not in therapy, not in medication, not in anything. And I will put my life down for it. Because I've seen it. I've seen changes. The changes that have taken place have empowered me to contain it. And I work with atheism all over the place. But for some reason, they call me and they tell me, what are you doing that so-and-so is getting better? What are you doing in groups that there's no problems there? I'm in juvenile hall now with minors. My group, I have to get on my knees every morning and ask God to fill that room with the Holy Spirit, because I can't do it. All my minors.
Excuse me.
They have committed horrible crimes. But in my group, there's absolutely no problem in communicating. They are receiving. And it's not me, it's God. And I hope you tell the psychiatrist, you're not going to believe me. He goes, oh, I heard about you. I know you heard about my Savior.
Yeah. It's something you'll see in this book on Job, is that what's unique about humans amongst all animals, and Al, you're right, we're all animals, but we're a different kind of animal. We humans need hope. Every one of us yearns for hope. The animals don't. I mean, the animals don't have hope. We have hope. So we yearn for hope, and we're really not going to be mentally healthy until we find it. I think that's what you're discovering. This book really gives you hope. Gives you confidence that there is life beyond this life.
But to be the thing to be worshipped, like you said, and I loved what you said earlier, is not it's
not the book.
Christ himself.
Yeah.
That's who we're supposed to submit 24/7. And what's wrong with Christians? It's only here on Sundays. It's
yeah.
Supposed to be every single day, every single minute. You're ready for an answer all the time and be in our needs.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. Very well said. Hey, I've got a few minutes to actually get into some of our lesson. Let's see if we can do that. Although this has all been very good. I mean, I really have hope that things are going to happen in the lives of people like Peter Ward. Because, you know, it's good that they're having so much fun doing their scientific research. I just wish that they'd have even more fun in relating to the one who's responsible for all of that. So, anyway, last time we talked about what's called the anthropic principle inequality. You know, here we've been in this universe for 13.75 billion years, but we humans have only been around for, 50, 60, 70,000 years. That's the anthropic principle inequality. That when you look at the laws of physics that God chose for the universe, and by the way, he didn't have to choose a universe with gravity, with thermodynamics, and electromagnetism, length, width, height, and time. But he did. And he has multiple reasons for choosing those laws of physics and space-time dimensions. But given those dimensions and laws of physics, it's impossible, as many physicists have calculated, to get humans on the cosmic scene in anything less than about 14 billion years. However, those same laws of physics and dimensions of space and time make it impossible for humans to live in a civilized state for anything longer than what John Barrow and Frank Tipler calculated to be a maximum of 41,000 years. From my perspective, I think it's more like 20,000 years, but hey, it's only a factor or two difference. But as you look at the difference between, say, 20,000 years and 14 billion years, that's a factor of a million. It takes a million times more time to prepare a home for us than the maximum time in which we can live in a civilized state. Now, that led Brandon Carter, who was the first to discover this inequality, he's a British cosmologist, to conclude that we human beings must have extremely high value and an extremely important ultimate purpose and destiny. I'll explain how all that worked out, but that's the conclusion he came to. But what I want to do is kind of take you through some of the science that proves this inequality. Because this was a real stunner on the scientific community when it was first proposed in the 1980s. But here are some of the reasons. And this is some we actually covered 2 weeks ago, so I'll take you through this quickly. That for advanced life to be possible, you need to be living on a planet that's got oceans and continents. That's something that Peter Ward and I completely agree on. You cannot have advanced life unless you've got a planet with oceans and continents, and that's not going to happen unless you have a planet that's super enriched with uranium and thorium. Those are long-lived radiometric elements that provide the energy source that transforms a planet from a water world. Remember Genesis 1-2? Water covered the whole face of the earth. That transforms that water world into a planet where you've got both oceans and continents together. Where does that uranium and thorium come from? It comes from supernova eruptions, supergiant stars that will end their burning cycle with an explosive production of heavy elements, including uranium and thorium. So when star formation is aggressive, the abundance of uranium and thorium build up in the universe. But when star formation begins to subside, the uranium and thorium are decaying, and so there will be a period when the amount of uranium and thorium gets less and less in the history of the universe. And if you look at that blue dotted line, that represents the point when uranium and thorium hit a peak abundance in the universe, which is identical to the time that God formed planet Earth. He formed the Earth at the very moment that uranium and thorium had a peak abundance. Now, that's not all you've got to do to get Earth as enriched as it needs to be in uranium and thorium. In fact, of all the planets that formed at that time, 9.2 billion years after the cosmic creation event, ours is the only planet that has such a huge amount of uranium and thorium. In fact, astrophysicists have calculated, of all the planets that formed at that ideal moment, our planet has 16,000 times as much uranium as all the rest that formed at that optimal time. And that's because of two other amazing events in the early history of the Earth that we got super rich. With thorium, we have 23,000 times as much. Now, one of the reasons why you don't want to put human beings upon terrestrial Earth too much after 9.2 billion years after the cosmic creation event is that uranium has got two isotopes, uranium-235 and uranium-238. You do not want to be around when there's uranium-235 in any great abundance. Fortunately, it's got a half-life of 705 million years. So if you wait 4.5 billion years, almost all the uranium-235 is gone. Just a little bit is left, just enough to make atomic bombs and make nuclear reactors. But, you know, we have to sift through lots and lots of uranium to get the minuscule amount of uranium-235 that will do that. And as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, if you go back a couple of billion years, our planet Earth was filled with natural nuclear reactors, places around the world where the uranium-235 was sufficiently abundant that you had nuclear reactors running all by themselves naturally. And that's not a time when you want advanced life hanging around. We don't do well right next to a natural nuclear reactor. This is probably the most famous one, the one in Okla, Gabon, in Africa, where once you get water, the water acts as a medium that concentrates the neutrons so that you get a natural nuclear reactor running. And when the natural nuclear reactor gets going sufficiently, it evaporates all the water, and that shuts down the nuclear reactor. But what's happening here in Okla, Gabon, is the water would come and go. And so when the reactor shuts down, the water returns. That starts the reactor back up. The reactor evaporates all the water. That shuts the reactor down. This is going on all over the face of the Earth, if you go back into the early history of the Earth. And a second reason why you don't want to be here 4.5 billion years ago, but rather wait that 4.5 billion years, is the sun's luminosity changes throughout time. I think this is where I ended last time I was here, was on this graph. And the sun, of all the stars that exist in our galaxy, has the most stable luminosity history, but it's still quite a dramatic change over the course of its life. This is what it looks like. It gets extremely bright early in its history when it's accumulating mass. Why? Because the brightness of a star goes up with a fourth power of its mass. So even though the sun may be only accumulating, say, 20% mass, that doubles its brightness. But thereafter, it begins to lose mass. Young stars lose a lot of their mass. And as they lose that mass, that causes the star's luminosity to dim. And in the case of our sun, it drops down to about 85% of its current brightness. And when it gets down to 85%, it stops losing mass, or at least stops losing mass at a high rate. But what causes it to get brighter and brighter thereafter is that nuclear fusion in the core of the sun is fusing hydrogen into helium. And helium is denser than hydrogen. So as the sun's furnace keeps burning and burning, the density at the core goes up. And the degree to which the nuclear furnace burns is proportional to the density. So as the density goes up, the furnace burns hotter and hotter, the star gets brighter and brighter. And there's an ideal brightness for human beings. In fact, one of the things Peter Ward talked about there in Seattle is if you were to go back about 0.5 billion to 1 billion years, Earth had snowball events. The sun is too bright now for snowball events to happen. The planet cannot freeze over and cover 90% of its surface with ice. And so there's an ideal luminosity in which advanced life can exist. And you say, well, it looks to me like that ideal luminosity was reached 3 times. Why now and not back at the other 2 times? Well, if you look at the other 2 times, for example, here and here, where it hit the ideal brightness, I got some feedback there. Notice that the luminosity is changing very rapidly those 2 times. You really want to be here, where the luminosity is not changing at a rapid rate. So I could go over here instead. I already got a speaker there, too. That's not going to work either. But here's the real reason why you want to wait those 4.5 billion extra years. Stars are like human beings. They're unstable when they're young. They're unstable when they're old. Several of us are good examples of that here in the class, right? You're really in your most stable state when you're middle-aged. This is also true of stars. Our star, of all stars, has the most stable flaring activity. We have the least variability in ultraviolet radiation, X-ray radiation, and flaring activity. But this is what it looks like over the history of the sun. When it is very young, it's extremely aggressive and very volatile in terms of its variable solar flaring activity and the radiation of ultraviolet and X-rays. Bacteria might be able to survive, but virtually nothing else. Only bacteria can withstand the radiation and the solar flaring activity. And then it gradually drops where more and more advanced life becomes possible. And you notice it hits a minimum when the sun is almost exactly halfway through its burning cycle. It's now 4.57 billion years old. And that's when the flaring activity hits a bottom minimum. And in the future, that flaring activity is going to return. So that at least gives you a feel for why we need the 14 billion years and why we can only exist in a few tens of thousands of years. Matter of fact, let me just take an extra minute here. solar physicists have been looking at neutrinos coming out of the sun. And what they observe is that the neutrinos we see coming out of the sun testify that the sun entered an exceptionally stable luminosity phase 50,000 years ago. So that's when the sun entered its most stable luminosity phase, 50,000 years ago. Those same neutrino measurements tell us that that very extreme solar luminosity stability can only last a maximum of 100,000 years, which means at a maximum we've got 50,000 years left before the sun exits that stable, that luminosity stability phase. So again, that gives you at least a feel for why there can't be that much time for human civilization. Now, I'm not saying that it's that narrow a window of time for human beings. If we would be willing to return to a Stone Age technology with only a few million of us on the planet instead of billions of us on the planet, we could extend that 40,000 years or 20,000 years to maybe a few hundred thousand years. Not much beyond that, but we could extend the time. But you know, I've got two sons. I've actually talked to them about this, about whether or not they'd be willing to go back to a Stone Age technology. And they're basically saying, over my dead body, am I going to go back to a Stone Age technology? The idea of even doing without GPS satellites to them is a horrifying thought. So I think it would be a really hard sell to convince the human population, you know, if we want to live here much longer, we have to go back to a Stone Age technology, and we've got to lower our population down to a few million. And so that's why Brandon Carter said, humans in a civilized state. Now, if you're concerned, we've been in that, quote, civilized state for 11,000 years. That's what's called the Neolithic Revolution. That time in human history when humans began to build towns where the people in each town would specialize on a particular economic activity and they would trade with one another. That's only been going on for 11,000 years. According to our calculations of reasons to believe, we can only sustain that level of technology for about another maximum of 9,000 years before we either have to go back to a Stone Age or really it's the end of civilization as we know it. And it's actually could be a lot briefer than that if you're talking the level of civilization we have right now. The higher the level of civilization, the more brief that window of time must be. We'll talk a little bit about that next week. I've held you over 5 minutes. Let's bow and pray, and we'll take this up. By the way, next week I will be in Vancouver. I got another week-long trip where we're going to be doing a number of debates. This time we'll be debating theistic evolutionists from Trinity Western and a Regent Seminary up there in Vancouver, as well as speaking a number of churches. Go to our website. You'll see what both Buzz and I will be doing. Appreciate your prayers. It will be another stressful trip, but I also think a trip with some amazing spiritual opportunities. So I really do appreciate your prayers. And please pray for the people who take my place here. I mean, we got some amazing teachers here in this class, and that's one of the reasons why I have the freedom to travel. I know that when I'm gone, you've got really outstanding teaching here, and I love the fact that there's at least a half dozen of you that are willing to step in and to provide that kind of teaching. So let's bow. Father in heaven, we do want to thank you for the amazing time in which you've allowed each one of us to live. Lord, where there's so much new learning and understanding and knowledge coming from both of your books, the Record of Nature and the words that are penned in your Bible. Thank you, Lord, for giving us the scholarship and the civilization, the technology that we can advance research at such an amazing degree. But I pray, Father, not only for the people in the class, but the people we meet, that we would be cautious not to worship your two books and fail to worship you. Lord, may our worship always and only be upon you, the author of both of those books. So, Lord, may we not be distracted by the amazing joy and thrill that each of us receives when we make new discoveries, by the book of nature, the book of Scripture. And Father, I pray that you would grant us the humility of Job as we go about this study, that we can always see our role and our place in the universe, and in particular our place with respect to you. So give us more opportunities, I pray, Father, to give good reasons for the hope within us with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. In Jesus' name, amen.